Pick up your paintbrush. It's time for Hobby Support Group, The Gallery. Good evening, Ed.
Good evening, Tom.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to The Gallery, November and December, probably part one, as we are here recording in mid-January 2024, and we realised, oh dear, we've not done a gallery for quite a while. So when I was compiling all the photographs that we then, through the power of Skype, share to look at while we record this, we realised you've been really busy hobbyists for the last few months, and there are nearly 200 photos to look through just on November and December. So probably what we're going to do this evening is record the first half of this gallery, because as much as we all like the gallery, those of us which, you know, have had run-ins with the orb and, you know, veterans, you know, I don't think anybody really wants a three-hour gallery episode. So we will probably see how we go when we're about halfway through. So this might be either a really long episode or a relatively shorter one. But if it is a shorter gallery episode, don't worry, part two will be out soon. Well, thank you for joining me, Ed. How are you this evening? That was perfectly timed.
As you asked me the question, I just took a sip of water like a professional. I'm good. I'm good, thanks. I've attempted to improve the sound in my room, which is a bit echoey, by establishing a kind of box fort of KR cases with a large piece of foam board on top. So hopefully you'll be able to hear the difference at home.
It's good that one of us takes the sound quality more serious. I think my blanket may have even fallen down. So, you know, the blanket I normally put up is fallen down somewhere.
Well, you've got the advantage of being in a room with a lot of stuff. I have some stuff, but not quite as much stuff. So it is a bit of an echoey room.
Hoarder. I think that's what you've been to my house, Ed. I think that's the polite, I think, description of it. Anyway, well, this is...
Many treasures.
Yeah, ramble. So thank you everybody who's posted everything up on the Facebook group the last few months. Before we started recording, Ed and I were actually like both discussing how it does seem to be, due to the joys of the ever-changing Facebook algorithm, harder to notice stuff. Because I know when I was going through all the images to make the gallery episode, I saw loads of stuff that I'd not noticed. And I do make an effort to check the group every day, and I've missed loads of people's really fantastic models. So please, if I haven't commented on them, like them or anything, please, I'm not ignoring you or being really rude. I might be being rubbish, but the algorithm seems to not necessarily be brilliant at showcasing people's stuff all the time. I seem to see my friends' work posted all the time, but lots of the people who I'm not mutual friends with, I just completely not seen. So I don't know if that's just me being a technoluddite, if it's the algorithm or whatever. So please, everybody, keep on sharing your work, because it is great to see. And if we don't talk about it this episode, we will definitely talk about it next episode, because there is such a wide range of work that is truly inspiring and also so broad in its, you know, scales, genres, styles and everything else. Please keep sharing it.
Absolutely, yeah.
So jumping off to start with this week, and I think this is a great example of, you know, just how busy as hobbyists you'll be. We will move into Andrus's post, where he posted up, I'm assuming this is his 2023 painting sort of haul, because this is quite an achievement, Andrus. And I think this is a good example of, you know, so what does a hobby support group listener paint? And we all love a list. So I think here we have everything from cowboys, skeleton undead, krakens, sea griblies, giant spiders, near future dudes, ancient Persians, mechs, elephant riders, cavalry, pikemen, some snotling goblins.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something for, I think, every hobbyist in there, also a few different scales as well. And just, this is really great work. I think these are great. They look really nice. It's a lot of painting as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I don't know what all these are for, but, you know, there seems to be, like, a couple, at least I would say sort of, like, two large historical armies, a fantasy army, a couple of, like, war gangs for, you know, some cowboy games, and then, you know, the mechs and everything else. It's a really... I suppose this is what an oval list looks like when it's painted up and put on a table.
Yeah.
And, yeah, looks really, really nice. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, Ed.
Just admiration. I think that's a really good haul for a year's work.
And then, because this is, you know, Hobby Support Group and it's Tom and Ed, we can't really go very far without moving into the 17th century. So we will now have a chat about Andy Foe's latest additions to his ongoing collection. And here we have some guys, I think, who can tell it's been a very long war. I think, you know, it may be a while since they've been resupplied. You know, they may be a little bit ragged, a little bit worn. These are great figures.
Absolutely, yes.
Brilliant figures.
Covenanters, I'm guessing by the hats?
Possibly. I guess so. Andy's, you know, moving forwards in time, he's abandoning the 30 Years of War and coming into one of the civils. These are great. I really like the base for these, as these work as well. I think being able to, like, the single based figures, but working on the multi-base, but also making the multi-base in two parts. You can sort of, like, I think that's something that I really like, that idea. So, you know, if you're playing with six figures or eight, you've got the base, but, you know, as soon as you lose a couple of figures, you can move them out without them losing. Yeah, you're sort of traipsing an oversized movement tray around for the figures. I can imagine these are a really useful unit also, because I think they could either act both as like a... If you're playing like a really large game, these could almost be like an objective, couldn't they? Especially like the guy with a little bit of powder. They aren't actually a fighting unit. They're, you know, just some men mooching about.
Yes.
Or they could be a... almost anything that you sort of want for, a, you know, if you're playing Pikeman's Lament or something and you wanted some, like, irregulars or something like that, I think they work very well for that. And then, you know, a bit of dandy painting.
Absolutely.
Here, I think we have from Andy with a drummer and a rather quite fancy flagman.
Yes.
Now, I think it is something... I know, because I mostly paint 6mm English Civil War at the moment, you kind of forget how much lace and frill is involved in 17th century military uniforms. I think it's probably one of the few periods where you sort of get pretty dandy at painting a doily on your military figures.
Yeah.
Fashion historians will now be throwing their phones at the wall, going, they're not doilies. It's a good lace ruff. It's not the neck. They're not ruffs, are they? I don't know what actually is the, like, appliqued.
I think I just always refer to it as lace.
Yeah, they're like appliqued lace.
Yes.
Collared bits.
It's like an over collar, like an extended over collar that you pin on. And it's looks really good. And definitely benefits from a dry brush. I think this is a bloody miniature, the banner bearer, and the lace work on those guys, having just painted them, a bunch of them, is excellent. So really brings the model together, a good bit of lace.
Well, you know, listeners, if you want more fashion chat from Tom and Ed, please let us know. My wife is a fashion designer, so I can always badger her for the history of clothes.
Of course.
But now I think it's something like joking and like humorous. Like, I think something like that collar is really what brings the figure to life, isn't it? And it's what brings the period to life. And you look at it and you can kind of, like, instantly know that's like a late Stuart character. It's not a Shakespearean rough. It's not anything from like the Regent's period. It's a very specific, pinned in time figure that is kind of important to get right for your dandier figures that most, like lots of other figures, are like, don't bother with that sort of thing. Something where like Bloody Miniatures and the more characterful ranges of other companies as well. It's where the figures sort of stand out, isn't it?
And they, yeah.
As you sort of say, it's important to sort of get right.
And there's, even though there aren't the uniforms, or not to the same extent as there were with later periods, and most people were wearing quite drab clothes, your character models, there's such a range of different costume that they can have, because it's just their fancy wear, stuff that they might be wearing. So that's one of the big enjoyable factors for me, modelling and painting in this period, is that you have such a variety of costume.
Well, yeah, especially when you're painting like, you know, gentlemen or men of more, you know, disposable wealth. It's a whole thing about their, one of the main things about them is you show off your wealth and your prestige, your power in your clothes. You wear finery. Yeah. And it's, you know, the men are the dandies, women are comparatively more drably worn. And I think it's also, it's one of the things even that is like quite interesting when you sort of like read more about the period, you get the idea of sort of like the Puritans are all sort of in sackcloth and very drab, and it's like, no, they're still, you can still have a very dandy, quite sort of like gregarious Puritan. And especially not like, I think we often quite think anything sort of pre-1960 is sort of either in sepia wash or in sort of like monochrome, don't we? I think it's, but when you sort of like look, you sort of like read either like, you know, sources from the era, any sort of like historical period, but also sort of like look at like surviving clothes and that sort of thing. I think it's amazing how sort of to the contemporary, really gaudy they are. I think especially sort of ancients, like I know we've talked about it before, but like you sort of like look at like Greco-Roman sculpture and that sort of stuff, and you see, oh, it's just all perfect white marble or whatever, you realize at the time they were painted in, you know, that was more akin, I think, to us to look like something that was like primary school kids had painted in poster paint. Because they're just really super bright and super gaudy. But this is great. And it also, I like how they've got the banner bearer and the horse like hiding behind a, you know, a twig, like, you know, a bit of a hedge and a tree. You know, they're not just sort of like, so this is, it's a little scenic base, but kind of works on its own, and I really, really think it works.
Yeah, that's more Bloody Miniatures. That guy behind the hedge,
some sneaky, sneaky guy there. You know, waiting for someone to wander around the hedge and getting stabbed in the spleen. Like some, well, it's the joy of the Civil War. You can decide if he's some sneaky, sneaky parliamentarian or some sneakiest popist. You
know? Indeed,
because I don't recognise the flag.
I'm afraid I don't either, which could mean it's 30 Years' War, of course.
Or it could just be Tom and Hibbs don't know what they're looking at, which is...
Well, there is also that. That is not to be discounted.
Which is, you know, it would have been an unknown theme for the gallery with us, too, would it? I don't think we would be exactly treading new ground of tell us what it is. But I think at least, I do feel confident now to know what this is as we move into what Andy Oval has painted. And I think we can guess. We might be able to recognise a mimic.
Yes. Yeah. Like that we are, yes.
I think this is a fantastic mimic.
Yeah.
I don't know who made the model, but I think it's one of the best mimics I've seen that looks like a mimic whose sort of cover is blown. Yeah. If this is supposed to be a sneaky mimic, you know, you may, I'm hoping it's like a DC2 perception check to discover that this is a mimic, unless it's, you know, tripped. I think it's great.
I
think it's a great sculpt, but it's also a really cool painting, I think, especially like the eyes and the teeth.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'd like to know how he's painted those teeth, because they look really, really nice. I'm assuming this is 28 mil.
I believe it is, yeah.
So moving on from his mimic, but maybe something that could potentially be giving the mimic a bad day is the 15 mil Lee. I think this is that he's painted up. You know, Andy loves painting up a tiny tank. Who doesn't? Really nice paint job on this. I think, you know, the light anti-tank gun might, you know, give the mimic a bad day, as we do. And then as we all move talking about fantasy, I know in one of the hobby updates that we recorded before Christmas, we mentioned the unwell-looking alien terrain that I painted using the old Tyranid sprues. And so here we can chat about it. And they kind of do look like somebody needs to go see the doctor, have some sort of tests done, but based up in little clumps on some, guessing probably like coasters.
I think so, yeah.
They do look like alien spores, demon pods, eggs. Surprisingly useful, I think, for whatever you sort of would need them for. And I think actually that's sort of like, in a way, was like the unfortunate biological look to them. I think sort of actually probably makes them more useful for other things, because I think you could have them. I think these would fit in like a weird war game or like anything where you've got like griblies coming about, rather than just if they were like, you know, neon pink and purple or something, and they would just sort of scream 40k. I think they're quite good. Then I think Andy, I think, has sort of like actually like been really knocking it out of the park. Sort of trying his sort of different paint schemes, especially with the oil washes, because like I hadn't noticed these until I was going through the Facebook group to select these. I was like, oh, Andy's now doing like Banjitsu style sort of painting, because these again are grand. These look like something out of a, like, would be on like a YouTube video that tells you how to do this style of painting. Like, are these his like space weirdos, or have
this
you played
the
against
doomed.
These?
So they're specifically built for the doomed. So they have various biomechanical gubbins. The idea is that these are guys who are quite far along in their career as doomed adventurers. So they've slain lots of various beasties and used their blades and acid pouches and other gubbins as weapons. So kind of a really cool mishmash of bits that tells a story.
I think they work brilliantly. I think also as kit bashes, I think they work really great, because even when you can like recognize where all the bits come from, they just look like multi-part kits.
Yeah.
Well, they don't even look like multiple kits. They just look like figures.
Yeah.
They don't look like the sort of, yeah, like all the, like Perry's War of the Roses helms sort of fit these figures really well. And, you know, it's like, you know, the old auto pistol and like the cutlass bodies and, you know, like a bone sword and that sort of thing. They just look, I think these are really great.
Yeah.
Sorry, I missed these because they, and the paint job on them, I think, fits perfectly.
Well, I think the first I saw of them was the other side of a table. So I've seen them close up and in the flesh.
So did they murder your doomed guys or whichever ribbly you were fighting?
I think they did. It was, we were
Andy
playing
dice.
Collaboratively though. But they were certainly impressive.
Andy dice. And then because it's Andy and he can't really, you know, go a couple of weeks without painting some English Civil War either. I think it's an affliction that we all have. Painted up some of the epic pike and shot covenanters. And I think he knocked these out incredibly quickly. And they look sickeningly nice. He even painted socks and shoes on them. Which is, you know, a lot. And I think seeing these now sort of like in the flesh, so to speak, you have to say that epic pike and shot stuff does look really nice.
It does, yeah. I think if we've said it before, but if I was starting from scratch, this is definitely where I would go.
Yeah, if I didn't have it in 28mm, 10mm, and 6mm, if I didn't have it in 28, I'd have probably bought these.
Yeah,
because they look really nice, and Andy has done, I mean, such a good job on painting these. And I think they look really nice. And I think also, I don't think they took a huge amount of time.
No.
Like when you look at sort of like what he got painted up, which is sort of like a small unit of cavalry, small unit of commanded shot, a light gun, two units of shot and a unit of pike. Like at 28 mil, I think even if you were painting pretty quickly, you've got the best part of a month's worth of sort of painting.
I'd say so, yes.
On that, haven't you? Whereas I think you painted these in about a week.
Yeah.
So it's great work from Andy to see. We'll see what English Civil War stuff he paints up for next month. Now moving on to Ben Still, and he's making some progress still on his Middle-earth strategy battle game stuff, which I'm really glad, because I want to play more of it. So chop chop, Ben, get more of it painted so I can come along and play it. Peer pressure. So yeah, he has Prom and Maggot and some of his hounds.
Yeah.
And this is Ben painting, so it's really nice, of course, because it's Ben painting them. Really like the bases he's done on these, and I really like the sculpts of these dogs, because
really good. Yeah,
I think bizarrely, like 28mm scale sort of dogs are something that are really hard to actually sort of get hold of. They're either like the size of hellhounds.
Yes.
Or like the size of a sort of particularly buff weasel. But nor do they kind of look like... In fact, it's quite hard to actually find a dog that sort of just looks like a dog. They either look sort of like an attack dog that's straight from central casting, so it's sort of like just too characteristically scary, or look a bit gormless. Whereas I think these, I think sort of tread that perfect line of sort of being scary, but you might also go, oh, come here and give them a rough, and they're not just going to rip your face off.
I think a lot of the guys doing the sculpts for the Tolkien, Lord of the Rings strategy game stuff, they really brought their A game. I've never really been a massive collector of it, but many of the sculpts are really, really good, and these are great looking dogs.
Yeah, I would say I think the majority of the Middle-earth sculpts are great.
Yeah,
I think there are, and I think the ones that aren't great.
Yeah.
A diabolical.
Yeah, there's a couple of clunkers, but
I don't think there's very much middle ground, and I think generally I would say it's much more like 80-90% of it is great, and you've just got the odd clunker. And I think the clunkers are quite often, I think, like a few of them sort of look like the faces especially have sort of been molded out chewing gum. But I think it's generally like I haven't seen all of the range in the flesh. I've seen like quite a lot of it in the flesh, like back in the day, because like lots of these models are like 20 years old.
Of course, yeah.
Now, aren't they? But I've seen quite a lot of the newer stuff. And I think the stuff which was easily like was directly referenced in the films, I think is all fantastic. Yeah. I think the worst range, I think, is probably like Saruman's forces for like the Scouring of the Shire.
When
you've got like the half-orcs and like Shanky's men and them sort of stuff, like some of them are all right, some of them I think are a bit of an off day. But I think maybe that's because they just didn't have like as much to go with as because so much of the other stuff, it can literally be shown like either like renders or photos from the films. Sculpt us this, whereas you've gone like sculpt us some half-orcs. What's half orc look like? Bloke who looks a bit like an orc. I think half orcs, I think in general, are one of those things that I don't think anybody makes a good half orc, do they? Because they always look
I think the if you go very kind of cartoon fantasy, you can do some interesting stuff, but nothing that looks remotely Tolkien-esque.
But I think with lots of fantasy, like Welcome to Tangent Town, I think lots of fantasy, I think it's quite hard to get sort of like exactly like what somebody's idea of like a hobgoblin is.
Yeah.
So you have like a hobgoblin, an orc, a goblin, and a kobold together. Sort of like, what difference do they sort of look like? In my mind, like a hobgoblin's quite big. Like a kobold's more like a lizardy small thing. Goblin's tiny. Orc is, somewhere in between, but much beefier. I think probably like my like visual idea of what they all look like is sort of like a mixture of like D&D, Tolkien, classical fantasy, and all these sorts of things. And you sort of like mix them all together and you go, well, so I suppose like everyone's sort of like idea of what a thing looks like is sort of like influenced by the experience that they've sort of gone through. And I suppose I think if you're coming into it from like a Games Workshop idea, you've got the idea very much like orcs are funny.
Yeah.
And like they are more like the comic relief. Whereas in most other fantasy, orcs aren't exactly the sort of light relief, in a way could be seen as good guys.
The orc has gone through various different identities, I think, and different kind of ways of looking at it. It is bizarre that you now have, through World of Warcraft, I think, something that looks like a Games Workshop orc, but has depth, which is just kind of so the antithesis of the Games Workshop orc.
Yeah, it's like it's a mushroom. It's got ambitory skills.
I much prefer that than like the noble philosophical orc or the stoical orc. I want my orcs to be slightly crazy, or as they are in the films, in the Peter Jackson films, very sort of dangerous. I was reminded of the Tom Mayer did a bunch of sculpts in the 80s for whoever it was who held the rights to produce metal figures for the Tolkien estate. And I've forgotten the name of the company that produced them. But those are really good sculpts and also look completely different from the films, from Games Workshop's version of fantasy. And I think they've sort of gone into a memory hole a bit because you don't see them around a lot. But I always remember them being really interesting, the sculpts, and I have a couple of the elves, but nothing else. So there are various different ways to skin a cat, but you're kind of drawn towards the things that you know, I suppose, and that probably means that the sort of imaginative soup of what these creatures are like gets lost and stuff becomes kind of staid. And, well, a goblin looks like this because Games Workshop says this is what a goblin looks like and there's no variation from it. I would say that there's lots of independent sculptors now who are doing interesting, weird things that's outside the box, which is cool. But yeah, that's something that has always bugged me is the idea that, we've got so much range in terms of the fantasy miniatures that we can have and the worlds that we can create. And yet everyone's got their comfort zone as to what they should look like based on the big, sculptors, big companies,
Well, I'm hoping that, especially with like 3D printing and that sort of stuff, people might start looking back to some of like the 60s, like artwork, because like, especially like some of that 50s and 60s fantasy artwork, it's really weird.
Yeah.
And like some of it's great, especially talking about Tolkien, like, I don't know if you've ever seen, like, I'm not sure exactly when it came out. I think it's like late 50s, 60s. There's like a version of The Hobbit that was like printed in the Soviet Union as sort of like an underground book, but it's got sort of like Soviet style artwork, like woodcut style artwork in it, which is like a completely unique take on like The Hobbit. Yeah. And like, I've got a copy. I can't read Cyrillic. I bought it for the artwork, and it's I actually bought it for tattoo ideas, but it's my tattoos are of special qualities. But like that sort of stuff is great. And I know you sent me like a Christmas card of like the four-armed alien Santa from the 50s.
Yes.
Which again would be like a fantastic miniature for, like, you know, anything weird. Give us some that sort of stuff. I think you don't have to just, as much as I love, like, miniatures that look like they've come from, like, a heavy metal, either album or, like, the comic cover from, like, 1983, as much as that is brilliant, it's also nice to maybe have some other choice.
Yeah.
You know, let's go a bit weirder. We are a fan of weirdness. And yeah, but then, you know, moving on from weirdness, and let's give us something odd to the flip side of the odd coin. And this is some of Ben's 15 mil Germans. And these are really nice.
Yeah.
I think that's, I know that's underselling how nice these look, Ben. But I think as gaming pieces, I think even as miniatures and like as dioramas just sat on the table as like machine gun teams, they look really nice. And I think one of the great things I like about these is I know how realistically when playing games, he's never going to use them. Because these are like, in theory, I could take them, but I never am because they're just not very good.
Oh, really?
Like, no game are they like sort of particularly, well, in most, like, you might take one.
Yeah.
You're never going to take four of them. yeah, you know, oh, I'm going to take an entire, like, I'm going to have an army in a war game that can't move. It's just going to sit here and, you know, be shelled to death. But he painted them up because in theory he could take them, or they were there in the company when he's doing his one-to-one companies. So you sort of like, you need them, but you're never going to really play with them. But I like how these are very playable with the addition of the dice cell. So you if you're playing a game with them where they have got, you should be using figure removal, you just track the wounds on them. You're playing like, even if you're playing something with them like Xena's Rampant, or you're using like a raw system like that when and you've got strength points, just having that dice cell on the base just makes the unit so much, I think, more practical to play with for when you're just trying to track wounds. Because I know, like, our friend Monk makes the wound tracker things and all this stuff. Like, we played like with those for years. We've also used loads of different coloured chits and all this sort of stuff to track strength points and all this sort of stuff. But it's just something I find really efficient about just having like a dice cell on
on the
base itself, where you just go, right, they've got, they're starting on five wounds, oh, they've taken three, they've got two wounds left, off we go. I think it just makes your battlefield look a lot cleaner. But also, maybe if you've got, you're playing a game which has got like different effects, or maybe it's something I've thought about possibly including on my big bases for my ECW stuff. Because like we play so many games where things are like shocked and stunned.
Yeah.
Or, you know, delete and replace with the applicable phrase. Just make two little cells and they're, oh, if they've got a blue dice in, they're shocked. If they've got a red dice in, they're stunned. You know, switch them around to things. So you're not traipsing the, like the tokens, when you move the unit, you move the tokens with them that show whatever they sort of are. And I think it's one of those sort of like conditions that might be worth thinking about when you're making gaming pieces over diorama piece and actually going, yeah, like artistically this could potentially draw away from it a little bit, but in reality it doesn't. And I think, like, especially how these are painted up, that dice cell could very easily just count as like an ammunition box.
Yeah,
like it might, looking at them, actually even be an ammunition box that I am attributing to a dice cell.
I think it's definitely a dice cell. I did originally, when you showed me the picture, think that this was, oh, it's just a crate. It's tastefully that the colour of the cell is either painted or naturally comes kind of beigey. So
I think it's definitely painted them up to look as like wooden crates.
Yeah.
But I think in most of the games that we play, I think we could kind of find out ways of hiding something that kind of looks crate-ish.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe with like the 6mm ECW thing, it might be slightly, you know, they're carrying around with them small grain, grain silos. Oh, they're digging field latrines everywhere they go. But yeah, I think these look great. You know, as ever, like fantastic paintwork, great modelling. Really looking forward to playing with these. And then to go against his Germans, he's got his Paras painted up. And again, sickeningly nice. Great figures. Look really nice. I don't know really what to say about these, but they're very nice. I think, I know we've had a chat about like his painting of these and going lower. Like I think you can't really tell, unless you know the scale of these, that they aren't 28 mil figures.
No, you wouldn't. No.
I think they are painted so nicely. And it does make me think possibly like in the future, some 15 mil World War II might be in my future, because I do like painting camo. Yeah. And I think these just look really nice. And I think for it, especially if you're wanting to do something like a company, I think it just makes it, I think it makes it feasible to think about doing company level gaming in 15 rather than 28. And then you get the joy of things like troops of tanks or some Stugs which are having a bad day trying to hide behind a small hedge. So then, you know, just go to stop, probably not the greatest place to try and hide from a typhoon. not reading too much into narrative here, Ben, let us know how their day went. But that is Ben's work for this month, and we now move on to Bjorn, and we start off again with some more future-ish, alternatively what could these be, let's, you know, use them for whatever we've got knocking about, some like Future War Space Soviets.
Oh yes, yeah.
I like these. I think like the aviator shades on the crash helmet is a look that more figures I think ought to have. It's I think it's definitely like a design aesthetic I grew up with. Don't know about you.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely what I grew up with. And I really like these. I think these are great figures. I think these are brilliant that you could have these sort of, you know, in one way, if you're playing a game that's set in 1997, you know, 6 years after the World War III, these are brilliant for that. Yeah. And also, like, if you're setting a game that's set in, you know, 2030, these are brilliant. But also would work in 40K. They'd work, I think, you know, anything. And I think they've got that sort of vibe on them. They could be like a spacer crew. They could be like anything. I think they're just like really useful models.
Yeah.
And I think it's something about how like a gun is always a gun. You know, like you've got the battle, you've got like the future AKs, which are assault rifles, whatever you want them to be, a rocket launcher that's a rocket launcher, some shotgun-y things that look like shotguns, and like a sniper rifle thing that looks like a sniper rifle. I think you instantly, you decide what they are. You know, if this is a 16 megawatt plasma rifle in the 32 kilohertz range, that's what it is. You can decide. I think they're really nicely painted as well.
Yeah, it's a really good paint scheme because it's quite drab colors, but there's spots of dark green and enough variation that you can sort of they pop out.
Yeah, it's sort of like, yeah, it's like kind of like a good bit of pop without them looking cartoonish, is this? I'm going to put like a big neon sign on my head. Yeah,
yes.
It's not the like, it's not the sort of like the Space Marine sort of like, I'm going to illuminate the weak spots in my armor so people know exactly where to shoot me in the eye. That kind of stuff. No, they look a very nice basis as well. I think I like how sort of like some of them have got the like the rock edge on the bases, and how that it like that design is then sort of like echoed in like the color scheme on the helmets, with the helmet as having some sort of like quite on. I quite like that repetition. And then again, I think this is one of the Mantic Forge Father
Dreadnoughty
things. But again, I think this is kind of a a useful model, which I think, again, you could have this. This could be, you know, if you're playing D&D and it's some dwarven mechanical golem.
Yeah.
It's some, like, Forgefather exosuit. It's some space gribbly thing. I think it's just a useful, cool model that I think you could sort of have. It was, like, a big stompy robot thing. It's kind of something that you can have in lots of games. Sometimes need a big stompy robot, don't they? I like the color scheme on it. I like the paint job, and I think it's actually. I think I don't like most personally. I don't like a lot of the like Forgefather range. I think a lot of them. I'm not a fan of the aesthetic of most of it, but yeah. I do quite like this. I think this is quite. I would have this like in my Dreadnought collection.
It's good. Yeah. And you could convert it pretty easily to make it less Forgefather-y. The basic body and the very chunky legs, good stance, low center of gravity, which is what you want. Even if you don't want to do it as a Forgefather thing, you could change it into something that looks quite different very easily, I imagine. Stick a head.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that you could, or like just with like a little bit of green stuff.
Yeah,
like you know, even something like, or like even just like with a hobby knife, and like change the head so like the head doesn't look like a faceplate. Just make it look more like a robot. But maybe like if you didn't know it was a Forgefather thing, it wouldn't look as dwarvish as it kind of does, because I don't think it doesn't like really scream Space Dwarf, League of Distinct Squat Dreadnought.
I think that's fair. I like this. I think of their big robots that Mantic do, I think it's one of the best.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, I'd never thought I might, if I see some of these at like a bring and buy or something, I might grab a couple.
Yeah,
because I think they are. I think if you were doing something like Xenos Rampant or like a space game and you wanted sort of like a walker or like some sort of equivalent, like a Sentinel or a Dreadnought or something like that, but you didn't want something that was just a 40K one, I think they said, I think to me, it looks something more like might exist in reality.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think I'm just trying to justify myself buying more Dreadnoughts because I like, you know, I've got more than one Dreadnought army.
I think I played it at one point.
Yeah, it's just there's just something fun about small stompy. But the thing is, they've always been rubbish. I've never, like, admittedly, like, there have been various iterations of 40K where Dreadnoughts are really good.
Yeah.
But they've always been iterations of Dreadnoughts I don't have. So I've had, like, oh, here's a really good shooty Dreadnought army list. When I'll have, like, all close combat Dreadnoughts. And then I'll be like, here's a really good close combat Dreadnought thing with like all lightning claws or chain fists and all that, like, all mine will have like none of those weapons. And so I was like, well, I could try and get all the correct arms I need for my Dreadnoughts, but then that's just madness. You just go, well, I could get the like 11 plasma cannons I need for these Dreadnoughts, or I could go on holiday for a fortnight instead.
Yes.
Anyway, but that's great. Thank you very much for your work on those, Bjorn. They are really, really nice. Moving on now back to the real world and the Cold War with some small-scale Soviets from Bobby. And these are great.
Yeah.
You know, the APCs, some infantry, and some heavy armor look really nice. Will admit, in my ignorance, I'm not sure exactly what scale these are. I'm thinking they might be 6mm because they look quite small. They might be 10s. Please let us know, Bobby. I think we've done good. We're 50 minutes in and we've had our first. Let us know. We don't know. These are great. Be interested to see what game system these are playing for. Are they sort of Team Yankee? Are they Cold War Commander? Or are they for Bobby's game that she's writing herself? I know she does a lot of rules writing, so we'll see what they look like. And some Americans as well, I think. And, you know, they just look really, really cool, Bobby. You know, please share more of this. Let's know. I like the Flames of War style bases on what I think are smaller miniatures.
Yeah.
They look really cool. So
I'm probably would never game this particular period, but I'm really interested that people are doing it. It's the kind of game where I would be interested to see folks play it and to ask questions. I don't think it's necessarily a period for me, a bit too modern. But as you know, my sweet spot is tails off when they get rid of the fancy uniforms. But this is really good work. And again, it's you can't get a more drabber paint scheme than, you know, desert camo on top of desert basing. But I can see what everything is, and it's been painted very clearly.
There is a documentary. I'll have to sort you out a copy with Ed, which is like, if I was to ever play like any game set in Afghanistan, it would have to be a game inspired by this documentary from when like an American documentary crew somehow managed to get permission to be embedded with the Soviets for a while.
Yes.
And there's like a sequence when they're like going down in like a supply column in a like a armored APC. And it is like the most quintessential 1980s thing of all time, where you sort of think this is a little bit sort of like laid on a bit thick for the cameras, until they come within sort of like a tracer wire or being blown up by a rocket, or everything gets a little bit hairy. After we've recorded this, I'll send you the clip of that bit. I don't know exactly how much like of a game you would have at this point. Press the ghetto blaster and drive down the road in your truck,
yeah,
avoiding the ambush. It's one of the periods that it interests me to read about. I'm not sure I'd necessarily want to game it, but yeah, then that sort of like changes all the time, you know. Or, you know, let us know what else. I've got these two armies painted. Here's the rules. Who wants a game? I wouldn't be going. No. we'll sort of see. So moving on from drab, really nice, but drab desert camo to, I suppose, what would technically be desert camo of its era. Some of Chris Lane's 15mm ancients with his Persians. And we were talking earlier on about how, you know, the ancient world was sometimes, you know, quite bright. I think Chris really did a great job of capturing that in these dudes. You know, we've got purples, we've got greens, we've got reds, blues, yellows. So everything and anything in between, you know. And I really like these. I know sort of like you look at like the fabrics that have survived from this period, or you read the descriptions for them, like the textiles people were making are sort of mind-bogglingly complicated and, you know, very technicolor. And so I think it's really nice to see them, you know, carried over into the figures themselves. And these just look really nicely. They look like warband units sort of mixed together, especially the sort of like, I'm assuming they're sort of like spearmen, like mercenary hoplites. You know, please don't throw books at us to tell us what we're getting wrong. You know, the dudes with shields and spears, they look really nice. And then obviously like the light chariot with the archer, again, who can't love a chariot. Then some mounted archers / sort of like light cavalry. Really nice sculpts, really nice paint job on them. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think the 15mm multi-base stuff just looks really nice. I think it looks really nice without being, despite, you know, being the owner of many multi-based 28mm cavalry units, they're sometimes just a bit unwieldy. Mm-hmm. Sort of like, just either like a bit unwieldy or just a bit too big. Whereas these just look more compact and just, I think, more user-friendly.
Yeah.
To sort of play with. And then also in a theme from, I think, our previous hobby update, was we've got a marsh and an oasis. And
yes.
Yeah. You know, I think if ever I decide that I'm going to, play a recreation of the movie Miracle Mile, I know where I'm coming for my LA tar pit for Chris. This is great. So it's a really nice marsh. And the water oasis that he made as well, again, brilliant. Yeah. I think that's a really useful piece of scatter terrain, because I think that can easily be, it's a pond, it's a stream, it's an oasis. It's a great objective.
Yeah.
I think it's to be honest, it had only just twigged just now, actually, how having an objective marker that's just a freshwater stream is a really useful objective marker.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's something that is useful in every single game that you play.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't matter if you're playing, you know, Ancients, World War One, World War Two, World War Three, your men need fresh water.
Yeah.
And actually going, oh yeah, well, we could helicopter in fresh water, or they could just get some from the stream. Quite useful. Copying this as an objective marker. I think I need some more objective markers because I haven't made any. Like most of my objective markers, like I don't. Do you have like a standard? I guess it's one of the things, because I don't play 40K anymore.
Yeah.
I don't really very, and like, I don't play Bolt Action anymore. I don't really play many games where I just need objective markers.
So I tend to use things that are very artificial looking. I have these big multicolored poker chips that I've been using for the Doomed and Sword Widows. We've been doing a lot of a scenario with objectives. But the only things that I've got that look kind of things that would occur in universe are things like ponies loaded with bags and boxes and things. So pack ponies, and I've got chickens and goats and some civilians that I could use. But yeah, I don't have any kind of scenery related objective markers.
Yeah, like I've got like I made, when I was playing a lot of Bolt Action, I made like a series that, like when I'm playing 40K and Fantasy, I just had like, you know, things with skulls on or whatever. They were just very like bright chips, or I think they might even have been just like, yeah, or like bases with objective one, objective two painted on. Then when I started playing a lot of Bolt Action, I just made some with a bunch of geese on.
Yeah.
Because I read there was like a World War II like Russian proverb of like, tie a geese up, catch a German. So I just made like six objectives, which was just like a wooden post, and like objective one had one goose tied to it. Objective two's got two geese, you know, obviously, you know, answers on a postcard, how many geese were tied to objective marker six? that sort of stuff. And then like, to be honest, I used those quite a lot. I used them for years and years, and like, so many games I've played have had, you know, the geese tied up. Or then I think when we started playing more English Civil War, we started having like pigs and goats and stuff turn up.
Oh yes.
The animals. So there's quite a lot of capture the animal, capture like the powder barrel or the water barrel.
Yeah.
That sort of stuff. Yeah, because I've got, you know, and then like our friend John, going to like from Oil Dome Industries, like gave me like his castings are like barrels and that sort of stuff, which I printed up, like painted and based up. But I do think something like a water feature,
yeah,
when you're just wanting a single objective, might be quite a both like a useful thing, but actually just maybe just give a bit more variety to your game, especially when we're sort of like playing these like campaign games,
yeah,
or games with like a multiple, you know, if we're playing like a bigger battle, but we're wanting to spread it over several games and go, right, well, day one is one force is at the top of the hill, the other force is at the bottom of the hill. Halfway up the hill is a stream that's popping out. That's the only source of water for either army. Who controls that gets a slight advantage in the second battle. Like, you know, who's got the water source at midday is going to be in a better source come the evening when the fighting starts. Could be interesting.
Yeah.
Bit of narrative that adds to your game if you've got a water source. And if not, it's just a bit of beauty on your table. So thank you very much for that, Chris. Looking forward to seeing more from that in the future. Now moving on to DJ Chadwick and some more historics, because we can never get far wrong from a historical figure and some of these test models. And these are really nice.
Yeah.
Very nice figures. Got to give props to the Not Goblin Green bases.
Mm-hmm.
So great figures. And then some Napoleonic British ranked up. I think he commented that how long these took, and it was like an obscene amount of time.
Yeah.
But they look gorgeous.
Oh, they do, yeah.
They look really nice. And I really like how much sort of like life and everything he's got into the trousers and the webbing and everything of them. Because you can just, quite often you can just think, oh, they've just got sort of like white trousers and webbing, dead easy. I'll just paint them white and they look awful. Whenever I've tried it. It's just like the painting in the grey and then like highlighting up to the white.
Yeah.
But in some areas, just, you know, really, really has worked on these, I think. And I know you've painted quite a lot of Napoleon British by this point. You've got any thoughts as the British expert painter?
Well, I wasn't, I think this must be Peninsula War because the trousers are a bit more white. I don't know if that's just a wargaming convention or if they were wearing whiter trousers because it was Spain and there was lighter fabric. But yes, I am very impressed by the whiteness of the white and the depth of the red as well. Great stuff.
So thank you very much for those. So we now, move into Mr. Eclectic himself, Mr. Dave Churchill, who is as eclectic as ever, both in scales, genres, games and all sorts. And we start off with a 40mm gladiator, and so really quite an interesting, fun figure. And again, I think probably quite a useful figure. It's a 40mm gladiator if you're playing a gladiator game, if you're playing a game and you need some sort of, future barbarian techno brute that's been grown in a vat or something like that. Works for that, maybe the enforcer for some sort of techno barbarian or something in some future wasteland if you've got 28mm figures.
I'd say so, yeah.
Sort of work. Nice paint job as well. Nice figure. Then, we're talking about, earlier on, we're talking about sort of like whimsical orcs, silly yes. orcs. Landyshek orc.
I really like these. I've always thought they're a cool idea.
Yeah. I want to know, do they plunder the clothing? Or in the in-universe, are there sort of orcish tailors which will do all that sort of like slashed like sewing and shirt making? You've got to think, you've got something like the orc who's going to control his orcish ways enough while he's doing all the embroidery. And he's doing all the velveting. And he goes, no, I'm going to do this. Do this today. Then I'm going to, tomorrow's a crumping day. Today I've got to get all these like inseam. I've got to do all this French seaming and all this crushed velvet today. Tomorrow I'm going to go and kick someone's teeth in.
I think this is a tailor-made fit. I mean, that's,
Yeah, I don't think you're going to be plunging. I don't think they're going to be plunging, are they? I don't think they're going to be like killing humans and going, I'm having that shirt. I think someone's unless it's magical thinking. I don't know. They just look at that and go, that's going to fit me. And then through the power of positive thinking, just say, or perhaps maybe even the clothing. This is a joy of fantasy. Maybe it isn't clothes. It's just their exo. It's how they express themselves. It's just they naturally grow with it. The more dandy and the flamboyant the orc is. The dandier and the more flamboyant they are. So, maybe we should be writing for, Black Library. We do this.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is.
Yeah, you leave an orc planet long enough, you come back and it's full Italian wars. It's like this is what they evolve into. You just some retelling of like Hawkwood or something through an orcish character. Yes, some orc war bosses kidnapped another war boss to ransoming off to a third war boss in exchange for some statue in a not market town called Yonyo. Sorry, listeners, it's been a day.
I follow you. Yeah, I can't fault any of that.
It's good logic. Moving on to again, like a miniature that you never sort of thought you would never sort of need, and then you see and you go, oh, haunted cabinet, be quite useful to sort of have for like whatever you need. I think especially if you're playing like D&D or something like that, and you want to, you know, you walk into a room, people fail their perception check, blah, the cabinet's got gained. Again, it could also be another cool mimic. Like a different kind of mimic. Very cool. Like very like a simple sculpt that just looks really quite nice. And like some sort of rather stern looking fruit baron. I think I'm going to go for that.
The man from Del Monte says die.
Yeah, definitely. There are probably some sort of atrocious crimes being committed in the background as he's sort of like overseeing them. Well, you've got some sort of like haunting in room, like Marconi's film score sort of going over the top. or he's just sort of like walked on set of like Holy Mountain or something, and it's an unknown protagonist. Then a anthropologist pondering the humanity. You know, again, don't know how many games you play with, you know what? I need an anthropologist for this, but I think that this figure tells you what you need to know, who it is, what they're doing straight away. It's a really nice figure, this. I actually really quite like it.
It's very good, yeah. Really lovely paint job as well. He looks like a guy who's been out in the sun too long without suntan lotion.
Yeah, just like the grizzled archaeologist. I think these are cool figures because it could be like ne'er-do-wells or law enforcement officers up to no good. Yeah, I think definitely the guy on the right is, if you just go for the like 1930s cop who's on the take. I think he's, you know, Mr. Shades is there. It's sort of like on the you know, high pointed for that. Like a woman reading a book again has that sort of like the vibe of she's either like just poisoned someone, just about to sort of like pull out a silence pistol and shoot somebody. Definitely sort of like up to no good nefariousness. Yeah. And then, a little bit sort of like the other end of, are they sneaky? Are they not sneaky? Are they up to no good? A quite simply loving looking Necron army.
Yeah, that's really good.
And I know we've seen bits and pieces of this posted up over time. I am old enough to know when Necrons were just the warriors. You know, the warriors, the Lord, and you then had the heavy destroyer. Yeah, the destroyers. These look great. I think these look individually. I think all of these figures look fantastic. Yeah. As an army, they look amazing. But I also think these Necrons, and I think Necrons again might be one of those like 40k armies. They can actually get quite a lot of use out of.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I think, like, if you were doing, say you were doing, like, a D&D campaign, but you wanted to do, like, a slightly different, like, dungeon crawl or something, you could have these dudes to, like, populate an entire dungeon with. And you've got minions, you've got bosses, you've got, like, sub-bosses,
yeah.
You've got lieutenants, you've got, you know, big bads. You've got sort of everything, and there's enough here to sort of do it so you're not just fighting literally the same miniature every week.
Certainly, yeah.
You could do it, and I think, but also if you're sort of like playing Zone Alpha, something like that, and you go, oh, here's like a level 1 threat, the Scarabs. Here's a level 2 threat, some of the Warriors. Here's a level 3 set, like the Lords. Oh, we've played several. It's like we've played a campaign. We just think at the end, either like one of the big Lords or the big Walker thing that comes out at the end. I think you've got enough like progression through these figures for it to sort of like really work. And not to look like you're just shoehorning in like Space Marines. I think they work really well. And I think they also look, I think the color scheme on these is great. Just, you know, the washed out metallics with the classic like green, but also with the like the slate gray and like the concrete bases. I just think they look really nice.
Yeah, and I think we said this when we were looking at earlier shots of the army in progress. It fits in with the lore of the Necrons and the direction that they've gone with the Necrons, that these new sculpts look a lot more like things that have been festering underground, kind of undead robots rising from the murks. And it accentuates that's the way they've been sculpted by the way that he's painted it. Really good.
Yeah, they do like really give off that vibe of sort of like robot zombies.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than just being like legally distinct Terminators.
Yeah.
But I think also like I think they scream Necrons when you know that they're Necrons. But I think if you'd never played 40K and these are just you're exploring an underground dungeon and you find some of these.
Yeah.
They just have that look about them, don't they? Of, these are some weird Elder Race construct, or there's some Griblies from like a spaceship that crashed thousands of years ago, or whatever. I just think that they really sort of fit for that. But because this is Dave, we don't just have, a little bit. Obviously, like Plague Marine, just to, mix it up a little bit. Then some tiny Cold War tanks, because again, why not just stick to one, two periods, two genres, two scales? Then, again, did you ever think you'd be thinking, do you know what I need? Dwarf Postman.
Yes.
that's what I need. Royal Mail for the dwarves.
That's a lovely diorama, isn't it?
Never thought I'd need one. Thought it's brilliant.
Yeah.
I do like how, though, if in this world, it's obviously there's got to be some. I don't know what game this is from. I do like that how there's got to be some sort of like underlying level of threat.
Yes,
because he's a relatively heavily armed. He's like a dwarf postman in just his postman's uniform, but is still carrying a short sword.
That's true.
So unless there is like particularly virulent, plant life that has to hack to people's mailboxes, I still like how he's just out there posting the mail. Might do a better adventuring in between lunch breaks. Oh, there's some kobolds. Be a pity if somebody rifled through their rucksacks while they're up to no good. This is great. Then this is like a really fun little diorama piece.
Yeah.
I think it just allows you to have just fun. Orc Commando. I think it's probably like slightly unsporting if as the dwarfish postman is just there, with his short sword and the Orc Commando is hiding behind a bush with a bolt pistol ready to nick the post bag. Might be a rather bleak intro to the game that you're playing,
I'd say so, yeah.
Yeah. Choose your own adventure, avenging the post theft. But you could just decide, I need a gnome and a unicorn. I think this week's selection of stuff from Dave, I think it's probably the highest collection of miniatures that I never thought I needed or would want until you sort of see them and you just hear the concept of, gnome wizard riding a unicorn. Yeah, need one of them. dwarf postman. Need one of them. Haunted cabinet. Could do with one of them. This is great. I assume this is a Warmaster scale figure, probably a 10 mil.
I guess so, yeah.
Figure. Looks really nice. Nice, simple, clean sculpt. Just enough detail on it, I think, so you can paint it really nicely without being infuriated by 4 million doodads.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of stuff. And then, we've done 28 mil, we've done 10 mil, we've done 6 mil, we've done giant stompy robots. We've done 40 mil. We'll now go back to 28 mil policemen or policewomen, because just to round it out a little bit. And these, again, really useful figures. Mm-hmm. You're playing a zombie game or something. You want some cops. Really useful, pretty simple, clean sculpts. I like how the blue from them is represented again in the base. I think that works sort of well to bring them out. And then rounding out the day, we have a witch hunter style figure with a very oversized crossbow and a MDF World War One era armored car, which again could possibly, you know, in my universe now, this is the dwarf's post van.
Yes.
You know, he's heard rumors of these orc commandos knocking about. So, you know, the dwarfish version of Jess is in there, man in the Maxim.
Yeah.
Ready to, you know, anyone gets any ideas, Mrs. Goggins is on the case.
Yeah.
In the back of the, yeah. Sorry, listeners. This is where my brain goes.
If you don't know what Postman Pat is as well.
I mean, they're really dating myself. I'm probably like really dating myself for like people who are like not in their 40s, who are like not either they're too young or too old to have known. Were you watching kids' TV in like 1985? A very niche British cartoon, probably.
I think Postman Pat had a relaunch. I think there's a more up to date version of Postman Pat, but I may be wrong.
I wouldn't be surprised. There's probably been like three versions or something like that. We'll have to ask our listeners. How current is Postman Pat? Let us know. Anyway, we'll try and get the show back on the road. And we'll try and get some level of seriousness in here when we talk to things. We should know exactly what we're talking about, Ed, because we're talking about your work.
Oh, gosh, yes, of course.
So we are now talking about your, I'm going to say, exquisite Napoleonic cavalry.
Oh, thank you.
These get smashing. I in fact, I think when these were originally shared, I think you might have sent these in like our Facebook chat. I think these got a full Patrick Bateman meme, which is the highly sought after meme of our friend group. No, these are great. I really, really like how you've managed to like make the bases look like the charge, like the churning up where the charging through.
Yeah.
They're looking grimy. They look like they've been out in the fields for a couple of days. And I think you've done, you know, fantastic work with them. How were these fun to paint or were they a nightmare?
I don't mind painting cavalry. I quite enjoy it, actually. I've never found them to be that much more difficult than painting anything else. I'm pleased with how they turned out. I did enjoy it. I think with all my Napoleonic projects, it's very much a gradual, slow process. You're not necessarily having a moment where you go, oh, now it's all coming together, because it's very much planned out in advance. The basing is just grouting that I, once I've plobbed it onto the plobbed is probably not well you know what I'm saying when I say plobbed when I've stuck it on the base, I just like sprinkle a bit of gravel on top, dab it in, and then submerge the whole thing in water so that it just looks a bit more fluid. And I've been trying to get this effect with Milliput and spending way too long on it, whereas, you know, grouting and this effect does the job fine.
I think it looks great. Are these the Victrix figures with the big
like, they are plastic? The Victrix figures, and they are really good models,
with like the big plastic sort of like puzzle base.
Yes, so on. That was something that I hadn't really prepared for. So there are a couple of these miniatures where the base overlaps the puddle base overlaps the base, the actual base. I did that on one model, and then I kind of shaved down the base so that it was able to sit neatly. Also, because there's so much sticking out, they don't quite, the back row and the front row, if I'm doing them in two horses deep, as it were, don't quite match together.
I haven't done the British Victrix. I did the French Victrix ones.
Yeah.
And I found like mine are individually, bizarrely for me for cavalry, they're individually based, but they're in movement trays. They're like, yeah, they're like individually based, but each individual base is magnetically fixed inside the larger movement tray, so they still work as a single base, really. But it's like Jenga trying to fit them in.
That's right. Yeah.
They can only fit in one way, because it's like, and they are sort of like, they were like, had to be like, right, this one needs to be like on the very front of the base. Right, this front rank one needs to be on the very front of its base. This one needs to be on the very back of its base. It's trying to get them all to fit in, and it was a nightmare. I think if I was to paint any more of them, I think I would probably intend to maybe have like a centimeter like strip down the middle between the base, to like put a bit more space between the two of them.
Yes.
Because I just think they just sort of like, because you've got something like a dynamic tail, or that kind of stuff, or like, you've got like a tail that's reaching out like quite far back, or like a head that's lunging forward, you can end up almost like a third of a horse length, sort of like slightly longer. And because like what I really like about like a lot of the Victrix stuff is you have lots of different sculpts of the horses themselves, don't you? You've not just got two.
Yeah.
So you want to kind of like mix them all up. It's not like, well, I'll have all the like the smaller ones at the front and all the more dynamic ones at the back to kind of fit them in.
Yeah.
But I suppose it's, I know in reality they were like the two ranks were relatively close together. They were really close together, but they're not necessarily like, even like as you've got them figured here, they're like, there's like 3 or 4 feet in like actual reality between the two of them. I think it would be fine. I think if you had like 6 feet between them, but now historians are going to like be shouting at us. But I think the rear riders are going to be far enough behind so they don't get their mounts' heads kicked.
Yeah.
But like, you know, especially if like, oh, if my mount puts his head down, it's going to get kicked in the face by the one in front of it, or they're not going to risk the one in front of it deciding to double barrel theirs because it's right of its backside. So I think it maybe is something like I'd never really twigged before that, oh, actually, you don't necessarily need them sort of like touching each other, because there was probably maybe a tiny bit more, or definitely probably like on the charge until they made the point of contact, a little bit more room to give yourself a bit more maneuver. But anyway, welcome to cavalry chat.
I would say if you're going to build any Vitrix, think about your cavalry base size, the depth of your cavalry base. I think if I did any more, I would go for a deeper base. I forget the measurements of the bases that I used. I just used the standard cavalry bases that I normally use. So
I had to use the 25x50s, and they used like every square centimeter of it, every square millimeter of it. And I think even then, some of them I had to like shave bits of the puddle bases down. Like some of them I was like, oh, this like one's going to overlap this base a little bit. But I didn't glue mine onto, I painted all mine and I didn't glue them onto the bases until they were all painted and I'd got the unit ready, so I could know right exactly how much room do I need to leave between like this one and this one. So then it was like a sort of game of fitting them all in and going, right, I'll start on this end, I'll glue one on like, right, I'm starting on the left-hand flank, this one's glued right on the left-hand flank side. Right, which one of these is leaning the most over to the left that can sort of like eat up this space? And it was sort of like very much like a juggling game, trying to fit them all in. And it was a challenge. Like, it might be easier if you're not super worried about basing size to maybe go, oh, I might do like a 30x60 base for them or something instead. Yeah. Or just go, I'm going to do like 25mm by 50s, but I'm either going to have like, I'm going to do 25x50, but then have like a centimeter strip between like the middle and then do another row of 25, like have another channel behind the two. Like the bases I've, like the movement trays I've got are like the indent in them is sort of like 50 by...
So yeah,
I think they're like 50 by 300 long, so they fit like 12 long, like two rows of 12. I fit like 24 horses in like the one movement tray, but I'm just like I don't have. Yeah, I think if I was to do them again, I just email war bases and go like, yeah, can you make it me like, you know, 300 by 60, like 310 millimeters or something like that. I just. Sorry, listeners, I know the maths, I'm tired. Or those maths I'm trying to work out are rubbish. But anyway, no, I think this grounding
technique... The only wrinkle in what is otherwise an amazing sculpt... I mean, they're great sculpts. That's the only sort of thing that you might have to do a bit of extra thinking about is how to base them.
I wouldn't even go as far as to say... I don't really think it's a wrinkle, is it? I think it's just something that you have to be... I think it's something like... If you plan for it...
Yes.
I think you're fine. And I think it maybe just is like, right, I'm going to be mindful that these are more dynamically posed. They're slightly bigger.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to be either think about the base. They're not just because they're just much better sculpts. And I think.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
I think they're far, far more worth the effort. And I know I've got my Napoleonic British 28 mil. In the pile of opportunity to do at some point. And I can very, very easily see all the long in the tooth cavalry that came with that army deal being passed or sold or given away and me replacing it with less better cavalry because some of that cavalry is heinous. We will not mention the manufacturers. But I think you've done just to talk again about the bases on these. I think it's brilliant. I think it's that milliput gravel water combo seems to work really well. I think this looks like really, really good. It doesn't look like a swamp, but it does sort of look like earth that's been churned up. And I think churned up earth, I think is quite hard to do because, like, I know whenever I quite often do it, all of a sudden you base that you're kind of looking to sort of look a bit churned up, all of a sudden you're sort of turned into Passchendaele. Or it looks like they're sort of fighting in a dust bowl. I think this looks, I really like this, but I think you could sort of like take this either way, couldn't you? I think if you like painted the surface, then like gave it like a very matte coating. It would look, I think, more like summer baked dry dust. Whereas if you gave it like a very gloss coat on the top, I think it would just like look. You'd get away with, well, this is the opening gambit of like, you know, some action which is going to turn into a quagmire.
I think it was. I used burnt umber acrylic ink to go over the because you know with the. Grouting, it's just white with the additional sand. That gives a nice kind of effect because the ink pools in the recesses and stuff. And it's I love that particular kind of paint for painting.
So is that how you didn't actually paint them at all? Then it's just the grouting and the ink.
No, I did paint the grouting. So the grouting was white, and then I painted it with this acrylic ink. Burnt umber.
Yeah, so you just basically inked onto the white grouting.
Exactly so, yeah.
So I would imagine then that flows really easily. So it's
absolutely, yeah, it really absorbs it. And I water it down quite a lot, but if you want to give it, you know, a bit more kind of pooling effect or make the dirt a bit darker in areas, you can layer it up. So yeah.
I would imagine though, is that also though actually quite controllable on the brush for when you actually paint it? Because like one of the things I always pretty much do the painting on my bases before I paint the figure.
Oh, really? Yes.
Okay. Because I find quite often when I like paint a figure and then I'll paint the base, I'll end up getting base paint on the figure.
Just I think in this context, it's creator. Okay, because I'm trying to make them like they're charging through mud.
Yeah, so. I was going to say, I can imagine it. It's, but I would imagine also, like, it's probably much, I imagine, like, using, like, an ink on the base is going to be a lot easier than sort of, like, nearly all my bases I paint in, like, Vallejo Soviet Green Primer.
Yeah.
Which is, like, it's admittedly, it's a pretty thin primer, but it is, like, a proper paint that you need to sort of, like, brush on properly. Whereas, like, if it's an ink that you can more sort of, like, mop on. But also, as you said, if you're getting a dash of ink on them, it's not going to stand out as much as if you here's some like watered down like raw umber, like burnt umber paint. They just direct, but I'm probably going to nick that ink.
I would say the acrylic ink can be a bit more expensive, but a pot will go a long way.
It's, I think, especially, I don't know about you, but I find this with basing. You might be painting up a unit that you spend like 30, 40, 50 pounds on. And you'll go, oh, I'm going to do my bases. And I'm going to then like nickel and dime myself out of like 50p to either go like, or it's like, oh, I'm not paying. Or you'll go, yeah, especially since like, yeah, like I'm not going to use, like, I will use this cheaper ink or paint that will save me like, you know, £4 an army. But I'm still going to put like £20 worth of tufts on the stuff. It's because now it's like why I use the like Vallejo Soviet Green Primer. It's like it is a more expensive paint when like you're just painting it in the MDF and everything. Let's say I could technically use like house paint or whatever. A, it means all my bases are exactly the same. And I've used like the same. I bought like a bottle of it in about 2020.
Yeah,
and I've got like a third of it left. I keep meaning to order a new bottle, so I've got some knocking about. So like, yeah, I've painted everything I've painted in like the last 4 years nearly has been based with that same paint.
Yeah,
and it's just, yeah, and the same like inks and stuff. Yeah, it doesn't matter if they're like 10, 15 quid a bottle. They're going to last you ages, aren't they?
Totally.
And another, like, I bought a bottle of like white ink for doing like whitewashing like World War II vehicles, because I was struggling to work out a good way of whitewashing vehicles, and then I realized paint them normally, like paint them in their summer camo scheme, varnish them, seal them all up, cover them in white ink, wash it off with a cloth, gives a really good effect that someone's taken a tank that's in a camo scheme, been given like a bucket of whitewash and a sweeping brush and told paint this. It's a really good effect, and it's just white ink. I'm a lazy painter. But anyway, talking about not lazy painting. Have you got any more plans for doing these now that you've painted, you know, 2 dozen of them? Do any more?
My next thing on mine, British Napoleonics in 28mm, is a unit of Highlanders. I bought them and they're in a box. That's as far as I've got with them. I've also ordered, as part of a joint order with a couple of other people, some of the Brigade Games Chosen Men miniatures that you can only buy in the States. So we're going to split the tax and the postage and stuff. So hopefully it won't be too horrendous. And so at some point I'll be adding more riflemen. But of all the various attempts to sculpt Richard Sharp, the one that looks the best is the Paul Hicks sculpt that Brigade Games do. And so that I felt like I'd given the opportunity, it'd be a good thing to get hold of. So I might be doing some more riflemen as well. So those are my priorities in terms of this particular project.
Well, I think you and Ben can then maybe make like your own little sub hobby support group for, you know, Napoleonic Highlanders painters support group.
Yes.
you can have properly in-depth sock chat.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, looking forward to seeing them. And then, you also branched out into some 17th century interesting characters.
Yes.
Is this one of the bloody miniatures? Or is this someone else?
He's one of the original Perry sculpts that is still being produced by War Games Foundry. Brian Ansell, RIP's company. I was painting some of the those Perry sculpts when I found out the news that he died. So I felt like it was testament to the guy that, as well as like founding the hobby essentially in its modern form, he also, as a retirement project, enabled all these sculpts to be still in production. And the Perry English Civil War stuff that they did, like 80s and 90s, just some of the most characterful models that there are. And this is the guy that you get with the petard crew, so an engineer, essentially, who's running away from an explosion, keeping his hat, having to hold his hat onto his head. I didn't do whatever the term is, you know, when you object source lighting. Maybe that's a thing that I should have done. But yeah,
that's singed whiskers.
Singed whiskers. But he's such a characterful miniature. Yeah, great fun to paint.
Now, I think it's a testament to some of that. I think especially some of the, like, some of those Perrys from like the 80s stuff, where they were like either like shoehorning in the historical stuff that they wanted to do.
Yeah.
Or like were just doing it for fun, is how they do really still stand up.
Absolutely. And
but not only how like they still stand up against like modern miniatures, but how they actually like still, I think some of them, especially someone like this dude, like sort of like, I think almost are still like at that pinnacle of like historical but characterful. Yes. And are like fun and like, yeah, tell a story within the miniature.
Yeah.
While also having like the right trousers, mm-hmm, and that sort of stuff. And I think like there are now many companies that do like maybe like technically better sculpts, if they're just like, if you're particularly bothered by like what the buckle on the shoe is like, even, yeah, though I don't think there's anything historically wrong with almost any of that stuff, but they don't quite often have the level of character in them. Yeah. or they don't lend themselves to telling sort of like a story as much, because I suppose like, especially like this dude who's like running away from the explosion, like he's sort of like in action, that's what he's doing, he's dynamically posing that he's running away and holding his hat on. He's not as useful if you want him sort of posted on a base, sort of sitting around having a sort of confab about where to place the siege mortars. Yes. Is it? Whereas like when you're sort of like more wanting figures to tell stories or tell narratives in your game, I think it is something just particularly sweet about some of those 80s figures, which sort of, I think, do really sort of like capture that, where you're trying to sort of like capture a moment in time.
Yeah.
And actually go, I want something to do, I want to capture just this snapshot, not someone who's going to be maybe sort of like sat around doing stuff. And I think it's, I know it's something like I find quite difficult when I've been doing like 28 mil projects, is like how you do commanders and stuff, because it's like, especially sort of like Napoleonics, you've got people like sat or stood around like a map table.
Yeah.
It's just so boring. It's like, what are they going to, yeah, do? And it's like, I suppose like really, you don't want your general to sort of be like very animated, or, you know, if your general's like diving for cover, or, you know, even if he's having to hurry, it's a, you know, something's pretty much gone wrong, hasn't he? He should be, you know,
yeah,
very chilled out and be, you know, quite safe and calm doing what he's doing. I know that often that doesn't happen, but I think it's just, yeah, it's just one of those things that I think is great, and I think you've done a great job.
Thank you.
On this dude. And then is this you testing out your influencer credentials to now go, we're pushing the boundaries of a 17th century warfare, but are you now going 17th century on hex bases? Yeah, it's where the cool kids are.
Yeah, I found some hex bases at the club in the club bits box, and I thought, oh, I'll make some use of those at some point. And I had the Dragoons ready to be based, and I suddenly thought, how am I going to tell that these guys are Dragoons from all the other guys with guns that I've got? And so, muskets, rather. And so, yeah, I thought, well, why not? Let's put them on the hex base. I think it'll work all right. I mean, it does mean that if I want to grow this unit, I need to source more hex spaces. So I only had six. I've used four of them. But yeah, I think they work fine.
I really like it. I think they work really well. I think they work great, especially for something like Dragoons or like irregular units.
Yes.
Where like you might want, yeah, you want to instantly tell what they are. But I think also, like, I don't know what frontage you've used for your units. But
I'm working on the basis of it's pike and shot, therefore it'll be loosey-goosey.
All right. But I think you could, like, even if you're, say, using, like, 15 mil frontage for your units, mm-hmm. and you use, like, 30 mil hexes or whatever, I think they would work really well. I think even if you were using, like, a specific unit frontage,
yeah,
you could still use the hexes, because also it allows you, I think it allows you to do things where, like, if you don't necessarily want, like, two full ranks, or you do something like Dragoons, you've got those four hexes with the Dragoons, you could have the three hexes behind with, like, the horses on being held. And that sort of thing. And then it would make, or you could have, like, two hexes with the horses being held or whatever. I think they would sort of, like, work really well for that. And definitely, like, being able to visually tell on the table what are different unit types. Or something like Commanded Shot.
Yeah.
Or something like that, where you've got, well, actually, or, but also, you might want to be able to grow the units slightly big, like, bigger or smaller. You go, well, I might want, like, a five or six bases in this Commanded Shot unit, or I might want, like, eight bases in it. I think having the hexes maybe it might allow you to do that slightly mm-hmm. easier than with the squares, because you'd be able to tell, no, I think it's a great idea. And I think especially when it's games that you're playing yourself,
mm-hmm.
and you come up with the logic for what it is, and you go, well, yeah, this unit uses hexes. What are you going to do?
I can't see anyone having a problem with it.
No, and I think something that I've noticed with, like, lots of people that paint stuff up, I think breaking up, like, not maybe having, like, the rigid, straight, like, line movement trays and boxes, that I think it actually helps disguise the bases of the unit a little bit more, because your eye just doesn't follow the straight lines.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah,
I think, like, even like these are on, like, plain MDF at the moment.
Yeah,
but they seem to, like, the bases, I think, kind of, like, blend away a lot more than if they were on straight MDF, because your eye just doesn't follow that long straight line.
Yeah,
I know. I think it's like why I always think, like, if we go back to, like, Andy Foe's, like, that small unit he had on the Iggledy Piggledy, like, skirmisher base on the round figures, I think those sort of, like, Iggledy Piggledy frontages bases, I think, just look a lot better.
Yeah.
And I know, like, Andy on some of his, Andy Oval, like, other Andy, on his War of the Roses stuff, I think he's used some of those, like, sawtooth.
Yes, yeah.
Front bases. And I think, you know, maybe with, like, you know, laser cutters and, you know, all this sort of stuff, actually, we don't have to follow the, like, you know, set square, ruled square base in, but it's possibly something we could all think about maybe more often. You know, back to the horse chat from earlier on with those bases, what if you had, like, a base which had, like, a slight lip in the front of all your ranks, so you could maybe, like, nudge a few of them slightly forward, and yet they're still on the base. You know, if you had, like, a row, the equivalent of, like, a row of lollipop sticks,
mm-hmm.
just with, like, a slight undulation in there that just gives you that tiny bit more wiggle room.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I'm sure for, like, if people are, like, setting up laser cutters, it's not that much more difficult. You're obviously going to have a bit more wastage on the sheet and that sort of thing.
Yeah. But
I think, you know, imagine it and people will make it.
I'd say so, yeah.
You know, if that takes off.
You know, patent it.
Yeah, you know, it's the HSG racing standard. Iggledy piggledy. that'd be brilliant, wouldn't you? What is your contribution to the hobby? Everyone's bases went bonkersly shaped. The tyranny of the straight line. It's
non-Euclidean basing, you know.
Yeah, it's you know, the amount of, like, art manifestos and stuff I've read for workers. Like, this is the hobby manifesto. No straight lines on bases. you can have, like, straight line. You can only have, like, two straight lines in any four-sided base. Where those two lines go, it's your choice. Brilliant.
Can't argue with that.
These are the wormholes my brain goes, let's break people's brains when you game. You go, what, from what point of the base do you measure at? The lead nodule? Or the center of gravity of the base?
Yes, yeah.
Or just play with people who, when you say, where shall I measure the base from? Just say, wherever, and it doesn't really matter. Because I don't think, you know, well, you know, that cavalry, if you're measuring from that part of the base, you technically that cavalry unit's got like a fetlock in front of the rest of them. What's going on? Anyway, I think on that point, so we're going to call it quits there for today, listeners, because we are just actually less than halfway through everybody we're going to look through. We've still got to look at George Bell's, John Martin's, Martin Smith's, Sean Mandel, Sorens, Steve Harbour, Stephen Kellen, me, and the Warren Standard. So worry not, those people. Your work has been noted. It is in the folder. We will record the second part either this week or next week. So the gallery part two will be out very soon. Hopefully going to be having a Meet the Hobbyist out soon as well, where we talk about a rather amazing Star Wars themed board that some of you may have seen last year. Hopefully once we're all sort of caught up again, we'll get back to doing the galleries once a month, so you're not sort of waiting, you know, 8-9 weeks to hear us chat about, can you let us know what that is? You know, I can't remember, it's, you know, they've gone. So thank you very much, Ed. Thank you very much, listeners. We'll speak to you all soon. I hope you've enjoyed this tangent. I do feel, even by gallery standards, I feel like this one has been slightly more tangential than normal.
Yep. I would say so, yeah. I mean, the joke is that we, before we started recording, we're looking at the amount of stuff we had to cover. And we were like, okay, well, we might, if we're really quick, we'll get through everything. And yeah, cue the most aggressionary that we've both been in any one of these things, I think.
I think the Soviet versions of The Hobbit was a good
Soviet Hobbit, yeah. Yeah,
that's it's amazing how I surprised myself at how good I am able at derailing this podcast. Well, thank you very much, Ed. Thank you very much, listeners. We'll speak to you all soon. Good night.
Good night.